1 Samuel chapter 31, we have a great subject today. We're going to talk about Saul's death. 1 Samuel chapter 31, we're going to look at three things today: the last stand, the lying swindler, and the lamenting supplication. 1 Samuel chapter 31 and verse number 1 says, "Now the Philistines fought against Israel, and the men of Israel fled from before the Philistines and fell down slain in Mount Gilboa. And the Philistines followed hard upon Saul and upon his sons, and the Philistines slew Jonathan, Abinadab, and Malchishua, Saul's sons. And the battle went sore against Saul, and the archers hit him, and he was sore wounded of the archers. Then said David unto his armor-bearer, Draw thy sword, and thrust me through therewith, lest these uncircumcised come and thrust me through and abuse me. But his armor-bearer would not, for he was sore afraid. Therefore Saul took a sword and fell upon it. And when his armor-bearer saw that Saul had died, he fell likewise upon his sword and died with him. So Saul died, and his three sons, and his armor-bearer, and all his men, that same day together. And when the men of Israel that were on the other side of the valley, and they that were on the other side Jordan, saw that the men of Israel fled, and that Saul and his sons were dead, they forsook the cities and fled, and the Philistines came and dwelt in them. And it came to pass on the morrow, when the Philistines came to strip the slain, that they found Saul and his sons, three sons fallen in Mount Gilboa. And they cut off his head and stripped off his armor and sent into the land of the Philistines round about to publish it in the house of their idols and among the people. And they put his armor in the house of Asheros, and they fastened his body to the wall of Bethshan. And when the inhabitants of Jabesh-Gilead heard that which the Philistines had done to Saul, all the valiant men arose and went all night and took the body of Saul and the bodies of his sons from the wall of Bethshan and came to Jabesh and burnt them there. And they took their bones and buried them under a tree at Jabesh and fasted 7 days." So this is Saul's last stand, is what we're going to call it today. That's a good, if you're a Western fan, that's a good term that they use in the Westerns. This is his last stand. Let's look at a couple things before we talk about it. Let's go back and remember, what was Saul? Go to 1 Samuel chapter 9. At this point in the teaching, Saul is not the good guy. And sometimes it's really difficult to remember that. Sometimes the choices people make and the people that they become was not who they were. And it's a great reminder that any of us can get there based on just a couple choices that we make. Go to 1 Samuel chapter 9 and verse 1. It says, "Now there was a man of Benjamin whose name was Kish, the son of Abiel, the son of Zeruah, the son of Becheroth, the son of Aphiah, a Benjamite, a mighty man of power. And he had a son whose name was Saul, a choice young man and a goodly. And there was not among the children of Israel a goodlier person than he. From his shoulders and upward, he was higher than any of the people." Go to verse 25 of 1 Samuel 9. "And when they were come, and Saul and Samuel, down from the high place into the city, Samuel communed with Saul upon the top of the house, and they rose early. And it came to pass about the spring of the day that Samuel called Saul to the top of the house, saying, Up, that I may send thee away. And Saul arose, and they went out, both of them, he and Samuel, abroad. And as they were going down to the end of the city, Samuel said to Saul, Bid the servant pass on before us. And he passed on. But stand thou still a while, that I may show thee the word of God. Then Samuel took a vial of oil and poured it upon his head and kissed him and said, Is it not because the Lord hath anointed thee to be captain over his inheritance?" So that is who Saul was. That is his beginning. He was the man that God said yes. He was the man that God anointed to take this place and to lead his people, in essence, in some way, to take God's place. God was leading his people, and the people, like we get, they wanted to be like everybody else. We blame our teenagers for that, but we're just the same. And so Israel wanted to be like everybody else, and so God allowed them. And this was the man that he chose. This was the man that Samuel showed the word of God to. And he had a good start. And when we get to chapter 31, it is a very, very sad end. Go to chapter 28. Let's remember how we got here. So there's a lot of things that have happened. He disobeyed the word of the Lord. He did not kill the Amalekites. He took the offering of sacrifices upon his own hands. He thought he could be in the priest's stead. He did a lot of things. Rebellion is as a sin of witchcraft, is what Samuel reminded him of. And then we get to 1 Samuel 28, and the last time I taught, this is where we were, and let's go down to verse 4. It said, "And the Philistines gathered themselves together and came and pitched in Shunem, and Saul gathered all Israel together, and they pitched in Gilboa. And when Saul saw the hosts of the Philistines, he was afraid, and his heart greatly trembled. And when Saul inquired of the Lord, the Lord answered him not, neither by dreams, nor by the Urim, nor by the prophets. Then said Saul unto his servant, Seek me a woman that hath a familiar spirit, that I may go to her and inquire of her. And his servant said unto him, Behold, there is a woman that hath a familiar spirit at Endor." So that is where Saul comes from when he shows up in chapter 30. He comes from the place where God had told the nation of Israel years before, "Thou shalt not suffer a witch to live." There was not supposed to be one there. And so Saul comes from talking to her and communing with her and completely out of the place where God wanted him to be. And he's fearful, which he should have been. Sadly, his three sons die with him that day. So this is where he shows up here. That's the state that he is in. He is not close to God. He is not talking to God. He is not communing with God. He is as far from God as one would ever not want to be. Has no idea what God wants, but knows this: the enemy is in the land and I have to go fight them. And it wasn't going to be a good day. Let's notice some things about his last stand and where his life ended. Number one, in verses 1 and 2, he is surrounded by the enemy in the middle of Israel. Gilboa is about the central point of Israel. And the Philistines came up there with no problem at all. Why? No one was there to stop them. Anybody know why? Because Saul's hatred and focus was on what person? David. That is all he thought about. And the enemy marched right up in the middle of the land and set up camp to start a war. Why? Because his focus was off. Better be careful. I better be careful in my life of the human beings that I focus on and leave myself open for the attacks of the devil, who will come up and set up camp in the middle of my heart. And I don't even realize he's there. Then all of a sudden the attitudes that I have and the thoughts that I'm thinking are not God's thoughts. They're not God's attitudes. They're not God's actions. They're the devil's. Because somebody bothers me. It's not a good place, Christian. It's a scary place. It's a dangerous place to be. And I'm not going to say that God is going to kill you, but spiritually you certainly will not have a walk with the Lord. I cannot have a problem with my brother or sister and have a walk with the Lord. God will not let us function in that way. But his hatred and his focus allowed the Philistines to enter right into the middle of the place that he was supposed to be protecting. And what's crazy is he had the ability to do so. Saul was a great warrior and a great military leader, and yet he just focused on the wrong thing. Notice verse number 3. He is sorely wounded. I don't know if you know anything or have done anything with a bow or an arrow. They're very, very destructive. They have sometimes, depending on the tip of the arrow, more destruction than a bullet does. And out of all the ways to slowly die, this is not one of them I would want. Who knows how many arrows he had sticking in him, to the point he knew he was not going to live. It's just not a good way to go. And you got to think about what are all the things that are rolling through his head. What are all the bad decisions now that are running through his head that he made to get himself to this point? That is how life works. People say your life flashes before your eyes. If it did for Saul, it wasn't good pictures. And it wasn't good decisions and it wasn't good memories that were coming to him at this point. You say, "Wow, this is really somber." Yeah, but it's a great reminder that the choices I make each and every day, the reactions I have towards people, whether in person or on Facebook or Instagram or over text message, they matter. The words that I say, the actions that I do, they matter. And I may find myself in a spot that I don't want to be. Verses 4 and 5, we have Saul's suicide. Pastor Hoffman has a note. He said, "A tyrant's envy and jealousy ended with his suicide." All of his hatred, all of his envy, all of his disgust, all of his planning to kill David. And he ends up taking his own life. David was never scratched, harmed. Probably the worst thing that happened to David, he was a little hungry and tired from all the running around he did with Saul chasing him, but that is it. Nothing else happened to him. Notice in verses 6 and 7, notice the surrender. He dies, and as normally happens in this style of warfare, the people flee. And not only do they flee from the battle, but in verse 7, they forsook the cities, and the Philistines came and dwelt in them. So not only did he surrender as it comes to the battlefield aspect of things, but the ground that the Philistines walked over to get to Gilboa, Saul surrendered that to them. And now the Philistines are encamped. They're dwelling in cities. They are living amongst their enemy. Why? Man, he hated David, didn't he? That was the most important thing. That was the only thing he could think of. And what's his legacy? It's not a great reign. It's not the wonderful things he did for his people. It's that now we have the enemy living in the next city. Why? Hatred, jealousy, envy, all of those things overtook him. He couldn't think. Because of the lack of focus, the enemy has the strongholds there now. Proverbs 13:13 says, "Whoso despiseth the word shall be destroyed, but he that feareth the commandment shall be rewarded." Chapter 22 of Proverbs verse 8 says, "He that soweth iniquity shall reap vanity, and the rod of his anger shall fail." Unless it's a godly jealousy or a godly angry, godly anger, God is not going to have anything to do with it. If it is for personal gain or just to make you look better, just to make me look better, God is not going to be a part of it. Vengeance is whose? Vengeance is mine, saith the Lord. Yeah, but you don't know. No, I don't. I'll be honest. I don't know. But I know this. God knows. And if God felt it important enough, God would take care of it. But maybe God hasn't deemed it important enough. Has anyone chased you literally into the mountains where you've had to live in caves? Not recently. That's fair, Brother John. No, I've not had that happen, but we take things so personal, right? We do. And we've had nothing like this happen to us. And we'll notice at the end of the day of this morning what David's thought of Saul was. And it will surprise you. Notice verses 8 through 10, he was stripped. He was stripped of his armor, his honor as a warrior, his head. And he was stripped of a hero's burial. We haven't won a war since World War II. Because we've forgotten that this is the brutality of it. This is just the brutality of it. What do? They come back to get all the stuff. And then to cut off a dead man's head. Why? He's the enemy. He was stripped of everything. He had literally nothing left when it comes to the end of his life. Nothing was left there for him. Nothing was left for his family. Nothing was left for his heirs to inherit. Everything was gone. Everything was not slipping through his fingertips. In my mind, it was gone years before that. Trying to think of what relationships did he have at this point in his life? Who was it that cared for him? Maybe a mother, but no one close. He is alone. What is all that from? That is from sowing some things. Go to 1 Samuel chapter 11. But what is interesting is everything's bad and negative. But we read in verse 11, when the inhabitants of Jabesh-Gilead heard that, What the Philistines had done to Saul, all the valiant men arose and went all night and took the body of Saul and the bodies of his sons. So there was a group of people that appreciated this man in his state. First Samuel chapter 11, Nahash the Ammonite came up and encamped against Jabesh-Gilead. And all the men of Jabesh said unto Nahash, "Make a covenant with us, and we will serve thee." And Nahash the Ammonite answered, "On this condition will I make a covenant with you, that I may thrust out all your right eyes. and lay it for a reproach upon Israel. Sounds like a good deal, right? This sign right here. And all the elders of Jabez said unto him, give us 7 days respite, that we may send messengers unto all the coast of Israel. And then, if there be no man to save us, we will come out to thee. That's quite a statement. Give us 7 days, and if nothing happens, we'll give you our right eyes. Then came the messengers to Gibeah of Saul, and told the tidings in the ears of the people. And all the people lifted up their voices and wept. And behold, Saul came after the herd out of the field, and Saul said, what aileth the people that weep? And they told him the tidings of the men of Jabesh, and the spirit of who? God came upon Saul when he heard these tidings, and his anger was kindled greatly. See, there is the right kind of anger. There's the anger that Saul had in the beginning of his reign. He had the Spirit of God in the beginning of his reign. And he took, verse 7, a yoke of oxen and hewed them in pieces and sent them throughout all the coasts of Israel by the hands of messengers, saying, whosoever cometh out, cometh not forth after Saul and after Samuel, so shall it be done unto his oxen. And the fear of who? The Lord fell upon the people, and they came out with one consent. And when he numbered them in Bezek, the children of Israel were 300,000, and the men of Judah 30,000. And they said unto the messengers that came, thus shall ye say unto the men of Jabesh Gilead, tomorrow by that time the sun be hot, ye shall have help. And the messengers came and showed it to the men of Jabesh, and they were glad. Therefore the men of Jabesh said, tomorrow we will come out unto thee. And ye shall do with us all that seemeth good unto you. And it was so on the morrow that Saul put the people in three companies, and they came into the midst of the hosts of the morning watch, and slew the Ammonites until the heat of the day. And it came to pass that they which remained were scattered, so that two of them were not left together. That is one thing that Saul sowed in his life that he reaped at the end that was good. These men said, that is our king. That is the man that saved us, literally, from losing our right eye. And they came, the valiant men of that city came and got his body and got the bodies of his sons and burned them and buried them and then fasted for 7 days. He didn't lose all of his honor, but he lost a lot of it. Pretty sad state to end up. Ever been at a funeral where hardly anybody was there and hardly anybody said anything nice? They're sad. I've done funerals before where it was just two or three family members, and not all of them. Not all the sons and the daughters. Just sad. Why? Sometimes we reap things we don't realize we're going to sow someday. And Saul had sown a lot of things that were bad, but hey, there's a positive. The men of Jabesh Gilead still looked at him as their king. 2 Samuel chapter 1, we're going to talk about the lying swindler. Now it came to pass after the death of Saul, when David was returned from the slaughter of the Amalekites, David had abode 2 days in Ziklag. It came to pass on the third day that, behold, a man came out of the camp from Saul with his clothes rent and earth upon his head. And so it was when he came to David that he fell to the earth and did obeisance. And David said unto him, from whence comest thou? And he said unto him, out of the camp of Israel am I escaped. And David said unto him, how went the matter? I pray thee, tell me. And he answered, that the people are fled from the battle. Many of the people also are fallen and dead. And Saul and Jonathan, his son, are dead also. And David said unto the young man that told him, how knowest thou that Saul and Jonathan, his son, be dead? And the young man that told him said, as I happened by chance upon Mount Gilboa. That's really the only phrase you needed to know right there. To know the angle that this guy has. As I happened by chance upon Mount Gilboa, behold, Saul leaned upon his spear, and lo, the chariots and the horsemen followed hard after him. And when he looked behind him, he saw me and called unto me, and I answered, here am I. And he said unto me, who art thou? And I answered, I am an Amalekite. He said unto me again, stand, I pray thee, upon me and slay me, for anguish has come upon me because my life is yet whole in me. So I stood upon him and slew him because I was sure that he could not live after that he was fallen. And I took the crown that was upon his head and the bracelet that was on his arm and have brought them hither unto my Lord. And David took hold of his clothes and rent them, and likewise all the men that were with him. The lying swindler. So people say that this is a contradiction in your Bible. Not a contradiction. Chronicles backs up what 1 Samuel chapter 31 says, because this guy is a lying sack of garbage. He is there for one thing, and one thing only, and that is just a small reward. Just a little bit of money in my hand is what he was looking for. What's amazing about this whole thing is that David has to deal with someone who plays the same trick that he did in 1 Samuel 21:13, when it says he changed his behavior before them and feigned himself mad in their hands and scrabbled at the doors of the gate and let a spittle fall down upon his beard. To feign means to invent fictitiously or deceptively as a story or an excuse. So that's the word we're going to use today. This young man feigned a lot of things. Number one, there was feigned sorrow in verse 2. Notice this is the third day. So it took this young man 3 days to find David. So I thought, all right, let's run some math on it. From Mount Gilboa to where David is in Ziklag, it is 120 miles. It's about a 41-hour walk, which is 13 and a half miles a day. So it's doable. Definitely doable. Verse 10 tells us that he did have the crown and the bracelets there with him. Okay, so he had some effects where David knew that at minimum, maybe it wasn't by chance that he happened upon the Mount Gilboa, but he was there. Matthew Henry says this about the fact that he had crown and bracelets. Saul was so foolishly fond of these as to wear them in the field of battle, which made him a fair mark for archers by distinguishing him from those about him. But as pride, we say, feels no cold, so it fears no danger from that which gratifies it. So this young man holds in his hands the effects of pride, essentially. The end of pride. He has the crown and he has the bracelets. Notice in verse 2, there is also feigned servitude. He bows to David. He does obeisance to him. And notice, where is it at here? At the end of verse 10, he says, unto my Lord. So he's feigning that now he is doing obeisance to David, that he is serving David, and none of those things are true. The feigned story in verses 3 through 10. Here's what we know. Go to 2 Samuel chapter 4. Here's another instance why we know this is a feigned story. Here we have the story of the death of Ishbosheth, which is another son of Saul that was not at the battle that day. And two men, Baana and Rechab, decide to take matters into their own hands and dispose of this man, literally of his head, as he slept in his bed, for David, just to do David just a nice favor, you know? Seems like a kind, friendly thing to do. So they do this. Go to verse 9 and notice what David has to say about this action. David answered Rechab and Baana, his brother, the sons of Rimmon the Berethite, and said unto them, as the Lord liveth, who hath redeemed my soul out of all adversity, when one told me, saying, behold, Saul is dead. So that one is this young Amalekite in chapter 1, thinking to have brought good tidings. I took hold of him and slew him in Ziklag, who thought that I would have given him a reward for his tidings. How much more, when wicked men have slain a righteous person in his own house upon his bed, shall I not therefore now require his blood on your hand and take you away from the earth? And David commanded his young men, and they slew them and cut off their hands and their feet and hanged them over the pool in Hebron. And they took the head of Ishbosheth and buried it in the sepulcher of Abner in Hebron. That's what David thinks of this young man he's dealing with right now. He didn't believe a word he was saying. He comes to him with this story that he had put together, and David buys none of it. A man by the name of Mark Rutland said this: you cannot curry favor with a person of integrity by accomplishing what you think they want in an immoral, illegal, or unethical way. And that was what was done. Now, he did not kill Saul, but that's what he was pretending. I mean, what a dumb scheme. I'm going to pretend that I killed your king so that you'll give me money. Had he missed the fact that David could have killed him on numerous occasions himself and chose not to, he must not have been told of those stories. So he shows up hoping for what? Just a little cash, just a little gold in the bag. But what's amazing is David does not buy it. Verse 12 of chapter 1, and they mourned and wept and fasted until even, for Saul and for Jonathan his son, and for the people of the Lord, and for the house of Israel, because they were fallen by the sword. I wonder how much surprise the young man had in that moment. When he shows up, tells his twisted tale, expecting cash just to be thrown at him, expecting him to be on the high seat of the party for the day, and they rent their clothes and weep all day. And my question is this, what's he doing all day? He's just standing around. You talk about awkward. Here he's expecting to come to a party that he is going to start. Like, because of the news that I'm bringing, you're going to be so excited that you guys are going to party all day. You're going to give me some money. It's going to be good for everybody. And he gives the story, and the exact opposite begins to happen. Part of me wonders, why did he stay around? Like, if this is the reaction that your news gave, why are you still here? Well, greed. Verse 13, David said unto the young man that told him, "Whence art thou?" And he answered, "I am a son of a stranger," and what? Amalekite. Wasn't somebody supposed to dispose of these people? Who was? Saul was. Saul was supposed to dispose. These people were not supposed to be in existence any longer. And how ironic is that? That he's the one that shows up to tell David that he's dead. Verse 14. And David said unto him, this is a great question. How wast thou not afraid to stretch forth thine hand to destroy the Lord's anointed? And I got to imagine several times in my childhood, my dad would ask me a question and I would just stand there and just blink at him. You ever have that happen with your dad? You're just like, I have no, you know, I know this is a setup question and I have no answer for you. And so here I am. And so I know the inevitable is about to happen. So let's just go. Let's just get this thing done. And I got to imagine with that question, this young man, it hit them. Ooh, this isn't going to end very well at all, is it? We're not, it's not recorded. Maybe this is a rhetorical question. Because David spares no time in verse 15, David called for one of the young men and said, "Go near and fall upon him." And he smote him that he died. And David said unto him, "Thy blood be upon thy head, for thy mouth hath testified against thee, saying, I have slain the Lord's anointed." Irony of the situation. He didn't. Your lies can sometimes have great consequences. He shows up expecting loads of money. He has the effects to show that he was there. But his lie gets him into big trouble. He gets no money. He gets no reward. Except if you're going to quote Aladdin and say your eternal reward, then maybe he would get that. Verse 17. Here is the lamentation. Here is the lamenting supplication that David gives. A lament is a formal express of sorrow or mourning, especially in verse or song. A supplication is a humble prayer or entreaty. Now you would think, as this young man did, that he's going to show up today and he's going to give this news and David's going to be excited. Maybe he's going to become part of David's team. Young men have great dreams. Who knows what he thought, but the opposite happened. And now we're about to read what it is that David actually feels in his heart towards this man who hunted him, who set him up with his own daughter only to try to kill him, who lied to him, who deceived him, who sent him out to get 100 foreskins from the Philistines, hoping what? That they would kill him. And that failed. Javelin thrown, not once, but twice, to try to pin him against the wall. David probably forgot more times that Saul tried to kill him than he remembered. And yet, this is what he has to say about him. David lamented with this lamentation over Saul and over Jonathan, his son. Also, he bade them teach the children of Judah the use of the bow. Behold, it is written in the book of Jasher. The beauty of Israel is slain upon thy high places. How are the mighty fallen? Tell it not in Gath, publish it not in the streets of Ascalon. Lest the daughters of the Philistines rejoice, lest the daughters of the uncircumcised triumph. Ye mountains of Gibeah, let there be no dew, neither let there be rain upon you, nor fields of offerings, for there the shield of the mighty is violently cast away, the shield of Saul, as though he had not been anointed with oil. From the blood of the slain, from the fat of the mighty, the bow of Jonathan turned not back, and the sword of Saul returned not empty. Saul and Jonathan were lovely and pleasant in their lives, and in their death they were not divided. They were swifter than eagles. They were stronger than lions. Ye daughters of Israel, weep over Saul, who clothed you in scarlet and with other delights, who put on ornaments of gold upon your apparel. How were the mighty fallen in the midst of the battle? O Jonathan, thou wast slain in thy high places. I am distressed for thee, my brother Jonathan. Very pleasant hast thou been unto me. Thy love to me was wonderful, passing the love of women. How are the mighty fallen, and the weapons of war perished? Notice the first thing that he calls Saul, and that he calls Jonathan, in verse 19, is the beauty of Israel. He calls them the beauty of Israel, and he calls them mighty in verse 19. These are not the words of a defeated, bitter man. All of the negative that happened to him by the hands of Saul, if there would have been anyone that we would say, you have every right to be excited that Saul is dead, this is the guy. This is the man that should be singing. This is the man that should be dancing. And David was known for both of those, and yet he does neither. And he calls them both the beauty of Israel. He calls them mighty. Why? Because that's what they were in his mind and in his heart. Here's what he knew. He knew Saul had made some bad choices. And he knew Saul was suffering the consequences of those. It's a good thing to keep in mind when people do things or say things to us. What are they going through? What are they dealing with? Yeah, but they shouldn't have said that. Yeah, but what's happened to them in the past 2 weeks or month? Why are they on edge? Well, that's just who they are. Do some investigation. Maybe you touched a nerve. And David is giving Saul all of the room in the world for forgiveness. The beauty of Israel, the mighty. Notice in verse 20, he rebukes the Philistines. He tells them no rejoicing. He tells them no triumphing. He does not want them to be in a place of joy. David said in Psalm 25:2, O my God, I trust in thee. Let me not be ashamed. Let not mine enemies triumph over me. David did not want the Philistines to be excited that Saul and Jonathan were defeated. Saul's enemies were David's enemies. Nothing had changed in that right. The men that Saul was going after, David was still faithfully going after. Human nature is to make your enemies, enemies, your allies, correct? And maybe from Saul's point of view, when David goes to Ziklag and he's over there with him, maybe Saul thought that, but we know the story different. David was feigning to be there. David was making it up as he went himself. Why? Because his whole road in life right now was not to hurt Saul. Why? He was the Lord's anointed. And you didn't touch him. And you didn't say negative things against him. And that was still true in David's heart. As we mentioned earlier, Romans chapter 12, verse 19, Paul said, "Dearly beloved, avenge not yourselves, but rather give place unto wrath, for it is written, vengeance is mine, I will repay, saith the Lord." David knew his place with God. Even in touching his garment, the Bible says that his heart did what? Smote him. It's amazing. It's amazing when you consider the place that Saul kept in David's heart through all of that. This was still God's man to him. This was still the king to him. All of the love, all of the honor, all of the tribute went to this man. And David didn't want the enemies to be excited. He didn't want them to rejoice. He didn't want them to publish it and to make songs over it. He didn't want the daughters of the uncircumcised to triumph. His thoughts of the Philistines had not changed. Why? They were still his enemy. He had not crossed over in that way. Notice verse 21. He rebukes the mountains. He said, "You mountains of Gibeah, let there be no dew, neither let there be rain upon you, nor fields of offerings. Why? For there the shield of the mighty is violently cast away." That word violently means dishonorably. Dishonorably thrown. And notice he uses at the end of the verse, he says, as though he had not been anointed with oil. Once again, bringing back the fact that this is God's anointed, that this is God's man. Always aligning us back to that point. And I'll say this, that as a subject in our culture has turned a sharp left. And God's man is easily talked about. And God's man is easily made fun of. And we do not have him in the place where God has him. I tell you what I would do. Here's what I would admonish you to do. Why don't you let God take care of it? God will take care of it. There's been some well-known pastors in this past year that have fallen. One after his death. One exposed and then more comes out and more comes out. Why? God will take care of it. That's not your job. That is not my job. God will take care of it. But when we get out of the thinking that as though he had not been anointed with oil, when we get out of thinking that this is the man that God has for the hour, when we get past that, we get in trouble. Because we begin to think, as Saul did, that I'll just offer the sacrifices. That I'll just stand in God's stead. It's not true. Pride will sink into your life and into your thinking and into your conversations, and you'll align yourself with people who agree with you, and you'll get in trouble. That's an uncomfortable subject, I realize, but it's true. Better be careful. He rebukes the mountains. He tells them no rain and no dew. Then notice in verse 4, he says, "From the blood of the slain and from the fat of the mighty, the bow of Jonathan turned not back, and the sword of Saul returned not empty." The blood and the fat of the mighty and the bow and the sword returned not empty. He sings about their might in battle. He reminds the people that are there that these are two great warriors. These aren't two losers that just happen to die in the battlefield. These aren't two pathetic guys in our army that, oh, well, we knew they were both going to die anyways. Neither of them could really, you know, wield a sword, and he had trouble getting his arrows out of his quiver, always tripping over himself. No. These were two mighty men. And David was sad that they were gone. They had taken men with them. They had taken as many of the enemy with them as they could. Verse 23, he calls them, they were lovely and pleasant in their lives. Now, for Jonathan, I could say with him, okay, I agree with you. But for him to say that about Saul, you're going to call a guy pleasant who was hunting you like a wild deer in the mountains? And you were sleeping in holes and caves. And this guy is pleasant. That's a different level, church. That's a completely different level. Once again, back to, well, you don't know what they did. Yeah, I don't. But I don't think it was this. You know, for Brother John, it's been a while since someone's hunted him. But for the rest of us, that's never happened to me. Have I had things said? Sure, so have you. But what has been our response to that, right? Are you looking at those people saying they're lovely and pleasant in their lives? Is that our reaction to them? Or are you looking for vengeance? Are you doing the nondescript post on Facebook? In our family group chat this week, my sister and brother-in-law are doing some repairs, some renovations in their house, and they took a window out. And when my brother Seth comes down, he'll stay with them, and he always sleeps on the pull-out couch, and there's a door in that room. And so we were, you know, as siblings do, we were picking apart. I was picking apart a window shade and making fun of it, other things. And so somebody said, well, what about the door? Oh, Seth said, well, what about the door? He said, that one's rather drafty, just asking for people who may stay there. He was asking for himself, but in a roundabout, just asking for others. And we do that. Vengeance is not ours. Vengeance is God's to take. And in God's time, he will do it. And when he does it, sometimes it's very scary. They were lovely and pleasant. He then, in that same verse, gives them two great qualifications of animals that we would revere. He said they're swifter than what? Eagles. And stronger than what? Lions. About once or twice a year, you'll read a story or see a story about someone driving through an animal park and they roll down their window to take pictures of the pretty lions. And then the pretty lion comes up and eats their head. So you shouldn't laugh. There's signs all over those places that say, keep your windows up. Why? Because those things still eat meat. And if you hadn't checked, you're meat. I'm meat. You can ask my wife, I love lion stuff. I watch it all day long. There's nothing more majestic, powerful, deadly in the world than a lion. But my windows are staying up. Way up. I might even double window the car if we go. I'm not putting my window down. About the eagles, have you noticed, has anybody else noticed a lot of eagles around our state as you travel? Well, here's the fun fact on that. In 1970, early 1970s, I think we had four pairs of eagles in the whole state that they knew of. Now we have 300 plus, which is great, but an eagle population that big, and especially with our coyote population as big as it is, you better be careful when you let Fido out the back door. Because Fido's meat. And as majestic as eagles are, they be hungry. And they'll just swoop down. You ever seen an eagle take a king salmon out of the middle of a river? Those things will swim with their wings across the river until they get to the bank. I'm out. I don't need to tangle. If you watch Deadliest Catch, the fishing show up in Dutch Harbor, there's signs all over Dutch Harbor because of eagle attacks. Mainly when they're nesting, because they nest in trees, but there's really not hardly any trees up there. And so they'll nest anywhere. And when you come near, they're coming at you. And that's not like a robin or a cardinal swooping for your head. It's a whole other game altogether. And so David puts these men in these categories. They are people to be awed at, to be revered. The lion is the king of beasts. He's greatly feared. Notice in verse 24, he talks about fatherly love and doting upon the people of Israel. He wasn't a bad king. He loved his people. He took care of them. Verse 25, he calls them mighty again. And then in verse 26, he deals with a man that he calls his brother. They are brothers in arms. Wonder how many battles they went into together. Wonder how many battle strategies they came up with together. We know Jonathan was a bowman for the time that David needed news whether Saul was going to throw javelin number 3 at him. What did Jonathan do? He went out and shot arrows. So both great mighty warriors. So this passage is twisted because of the last phrase of the verse, passing the love of women. So there's a lot of people that makes this a homosexual passage, and it was nowhere near that at all. You know where I think it falls? There's a YouTube series called Lad Bible, and one of the things they do is they set, the ones I've watched, they set a guy from World War II and then a guy from our current war together, and they talk about the differences of the wars that they were in. I was watching one from two men from England, and Specialist Nichols, who was in Iraq, Kosovo, and Afghanistan, he said this about his brothers. He said, when I was out there, it was, my lads are coming home, no matter what. I don't care who you are, my lads are coming home. That's the relationship I see with David and Jonathan. There is something, if you ask Corey Sullenberger, there is something about going into battle with another man that just knits your heart together in a way that nothing else does. And so for the rest of your life, that man is now your brother. That's the relationship we're talking about. David lost his king this day, and he lost a brother this day. And the Amalekite, who was looking for money, was sorely mistaken. Notice verse 27. He said, "How are the mighty fallen, and the weapons of war perished?" Few things are more remarkable in the character of David than generosity which he displayed with respect to Saul. This is a man of great character, and these verses show it. I'll give you this and we'll be done. Arthur Pink said, "He was not like those who secretly wish for the death of those who have injured them or who keep them from honors or estates." It wasn't David's plan. Why? Because David knew that God was taking care of everything. David was trusting in God. And in this next chapter, David's supposed to get the throne, right? But he doesn't go take it until he talks to who? The Lord. That's the character of this king. That is the character of this man. Not someone who was seeking vengeance, but a man who loved the man that hunted him. And this day lost his king, and this day lost his brother. Father, pray that you'd help us take things from this passage today that would help us as your children. First off, in our relationship with you, but secondly, in our relationship with each other. God, may we be honest with each other. May we be kind with our words. And even though at times we may be injured, God, I pray that we would leave those things in your hands. Pray that you help us now as we're going to the morning worship time. Father, that you'd be honored and glorified in all that we do. We thank you in Jesus' name. Amen.